I think you get a box that pops up and says, "Do you agree to that?" Because someone asked that we have a copy of this to post. We'll try to do that. Okay. Jan, why don't you introduce the speaker and then we can get going?
I think we can traditionally. Okay, they are already 22 people, so quite a lot. But let's give another 2 3 minutes
Okay.
for some other folks. Usually, quite a few people arrive, join just in time. Yeah, but not too many people, because for Japanese, every minute is a little bit of pain. Okay, so let's get started. So welcome everybody. So I'm chairing this seminar on behalf of Steve Deitman, Luis Alvarez Lusso, and Noemi Loco. So this is so we start another year of NewsTech generator theory cross something like that. Okay, I don't remember the name. This is a series of seminars that we launched I think 2 years ago. So today we host Kajetan Niewczas, and I think most of you know Kajetan. Even if he did his PhD only last year, and in a joint program of Ghent University and Wrocław University, and he in his work he combines theory, Monte Carlo, and he's also involved in T2K very strongly into T2K collaboration, as you see. Also Hyper-K, as you see on the first on the screen. And okay, so Kajetan, please start.
Okay. No, thank you very much for this very kind introduction and the opportunity to share some of my research. Well, Jan, as you already mentioned, yes, this presentation is mostly the result of my PhD that I have defended. Yeah, I defended it a few months ago. It's most likely I will have to update the title page of this presentation because yeah, nowadays I'm having my postdoc position in Ghent in Belgium. So it's mostly Ghent University, and this is what I will mostly talk about. But yeah, you'll see how it goes. So for those of you who saw some of my presentations and had a chance in the last couple of months, some of these things were presented already. But I will go into some of the more theoretical details of some aspects of these calculations, and I'll try to present the current status of the whole project and the some planned steps for the future. Okay, so the motivation of this study is are the accelerator-based neutrino oscillation experiments, in which commonly we produce fluxes of neutrinos that are not monoenergetic. Allow these neutrinos to oscillate over some distance, and then we capture them according to the probability given by cross sections of given channels of interactions. This is very important. This is a big project, but okay, I have a feeling that everybody here should be familiar with the motivation, the grand motivation of these efforts. Still, the very important thing in these experiments is the energy reconstruction, where it's usually done either by the kinematical energy reconstruction procedure, where we mostly focus, let's say, on one Cherenkov ring, or can be many, but mostly it's going to be, for example, a muon that appears out of a charge-current neutrino interaction. On the other spectrum, one can have the calorimetric energy reconstruction, where we try to measure energy out of all particles that participate in this in such an interaction. So one can see a very interesting interplay between mostly focusing on the inclusive kind of cross sections for the kinematical energy reconstruction, where all the integrate the exclusive information that we integrate over comes as more of an uncertainty of these reconstructions, while in the calorimetric energy reconstruction, we really need to know the energy balance of this interaction. So we really need to be able to predict particular exclusive information about any particle that goes out of the nucleus in such a process. So this is a challenging problem, and commonly there are slightly different methods of dealing with one or the other. However, this is my impression of the community that we're really trying to narrow the gap between these worlds and have our Monte Carlo generators equipped with state-of-the-art theoretical models that can not only predict very accurately the inclusive cross-section, but also the multiplicity of outgoing particles and properties like this. So within my presentation, I will focus on the nuclear response of the nucleus somewhere between the quasi-elastic peak and approaching the delta peak of the interaction. So this is highlighted in this slide. As I mentioned, the presentation is mostly about multinucleon emission. So I will discuss the one or two nucleon knockout scenarios influenced by one or two body currents and different combinations of these effects. And here, as you can see, as a function of energy transfer, exactly, I will start somewhere below the quasi-elastic region, but I will not aspire to model correctly the whole delta peak, as there is an interplay with a single pion production, and this is an ongoing problem of how to consistently account for all of these dynamics together. But I will get to this in a later part of this presentation. Let me start with quickly presenting the kinematics of what I'm going to discuss in the context of inclusive cross-section. I work in the coordinates in the frame of reference with the momentum transfer along Z, which is a very convenient, very commonly used practice, slightly different from the neutrino scattering field. It's mostly done in the electron scattering field, where one can very nicely decompose the interaction into various terms. You call them, let's say, hadronic responses, also leptonic factors with hadronic responses, where the C letter in all of these responses corresponds to the zero component of the hadronic current in this frame of reference. L is the third component, and T is the transverse, which is a combination of X and Y components, so to say. So there is the longitudinal physics. So in the case of electron scattering, after some simplifications, one can exactly decompose this into the longitudinal part and the transverse part, where longitudinal part will contain all the physics along Q, and transverse part all the physics perpendicular to Q. The difference between electron scattering and neutrino scattering, there are some differences coming from CVC, but the main difference is that actually taking helicity as zero, so removing the T prime response, the final term in neutrino scattering, and then if one wants to combine CCCL and LL responses, where in the limit of a massless outgoing lepton, one can do it into the single L response. So this is what I'm going to do in the future. Anytime I will refer to inclusive responses, I will think of longitudinal and transverse parts. In neutrino scattering, I will combine the CCCL and LL into the effective longitudinal one for let's say the clear description to be able to show the result in a more compact way, but I still have the transverse and the T prime response. The T prime response is actually the one that flips between neutrinos and anti-neutrinos. Okay, so what is our model? Our model is in Ghent, we base on the mean field approach. This can be widely very easily justified that if one thinks about the excitation energies of nuclear remnants and things like this, if one tries to plot some sort of a spectral function, the whole spectral function of the nucleus after interactions, one can clearly see energy levels. And these energy levels are characteristics of a mean field picture. But this is not all of it, because there's a next order approximation to such a model. One can include nucleon-nucleon correlations. And this is something that can be clearly seen on this picture, that sometimes in the for higher energies, and there's like higher momentum, and there's a non-zero probability of this nucleon having very high momentum in the initial state. This is due to nucleon-nucleon correlations. In practice, our framework is non-relativistic. So our nucleons are solutions to Schrödinger equation in the mean field potential. The mean field potential we derive by the Hartree-Fock procedure using this KERM2 nucleon-nucleon force. And this is done not only for the initial nucleons, but also with using the same mean field potential, we describe continuum states of the nucleons in the potential. And then after performing a partial expansion, we can describe the distorted nucleon in the final state. So what we do is an example of a distorted wave calculation, where the final nucleon actually still feels the nuclear potential. And if we think about the simplest case where we only have an impulse approximation, then one can see on the figure on the right, the one nucleon knockout is exactly knocking out one nucleon from one of the shell in our mean field model, and exciting it to a continuum state that is described with certain phase shifts and particular quantum numbers. In the impulse approximation, our operators are very, very easy. So the hadronic current that is gives us the amplitude of going from initial to final nuclear states is simply a sum of standard one-body currents. Can be found in the literature. These are like standard prescriptions. What is interesting about our framework is that our operator is we perform a multiple decomposition of this process. So our calculation in the end is a very, very large sum of all possibilities of going from particular quantum numbers for initial states to particular quantum numbers of the final continuum states in our partial wave expansion through an operator, which is also expanded into the multiple numbers. So in the end, we really have a very large sum of different angular quantum numbers, basically. And so using this picture, especially with this multiple decomposition for the operator, we can really also control the numerical precision. So the higher the multiple, the higher the sum of the multiples, the higher the precision of the whole thing. So this is the basics of our model. And let me compare to like basic inclusive electron scattering data to show you how the model behaves. So general characteristics of these kind of models are that they roughly describe the quasi-elastic scattering for in inclusive electron experiments. But here one can see that if we perform this kind of a Rosenbluth decomposition between the longitudinal and the transverse part, here you can see that the top row is the longitudinal part, the bottom row is the transverse part. For different fixed momentum transfers as a function of energy transfer, so one can see that there is this quite characteristic behavior that even though the cross section is relatively well described, we can see that the calculation overestimates the longitudinal part and slightly underestimates, especially for higher Q, underestimates the transverse response. So even though the cross section is relatively fine, the ratio between these parts is not correct, not according to the data. And we can also see it if we actually plot the ratio. So this is the transverse response divided by the longitudinal response. So one can see that you see the ratio is consistently below the data, especially for higher energies, the ratio tends to really go up. So the transverse seem to really dominate over the longitudinal parts. But the standard calculation cannot predict things like this. And in a few slides, I will show you what we can do about this. So the first kind of two-body effects that we can incorporate in our calculations is the effect of short-range correlations. So for those of you that are like familiar with, let's say, concept of spectral functions and calculations like this, what I showed so far is basically only the shells. There is no, let's say, this depth of correlations, smearing the shells and introducing some sort of correlations with tail for higher momenta and things like this. How we want to incorporate these effects? We do it in this phenomenological way by introducing the correlation operator, which means that not only we have the single, the one-body terms, but also the one-body terms on two different nucleons will be folded with some sort of a correlations between certain parts of nucleons in the nucleus. And very typically, this correlation operator, similarly as a nucleon-nucleon potential, it includes central tensor and spin-isospin parts. So as I wrote here, these are like first corrections to the independent particle model. So we not only have independent nucleons, but we start to have some more local nucleon-nucleon configurations that gets emphasized here. Also, since this is a two-body current, this can lead to two-nucleon knockout. So within our model, we can very clearly define when these correlations actually affect one nucleon going out of the nucleus, or when we explicitly have two of them. Well, this is something that, once again, I can refer to the spectral function model because it's very widely used in the community. This information is somehow hidden in that, and I know that in many Monte Carlo generators, for example, people try to say that, okay, if the residual nucleus was left in a very highly excited state way above the two-nucleon threshold, it means that most likely two nucleons went out. The strength of our model is that we can actually explicitly predict that. If we have a short-range correlations effect in one nucleon knockout, it doesn't mean that our nucleus was left in a very highly excited state, because only one nucleon left and we know this explicitly. However, if we have two nucleon knockout, then we really can say, and we can describe the kinematics of them, but also I'll get to this later. So how does it look like if we include these kind of correlations? You can see that there is a reduction of single particle strength. So in these plots, the dashed black line is the standard impulse approximation one nucleon knockout calculation. The colorful dashed is including the short-range correlation effects. So these are the two-body effects on one nucleon knockout. And you can see that going between the dashed line, dashed black to colorful dashed line, there is a reduction in both the longitudinal and transverse channels. And this strength, since we model some reduction, we can see that some of this strength explicitly goes to two-nucleon knockout, and this is the solid green line, which is the two-nucleon knockout of short-range correlated pairs. Here I can add that there is a one correction to this plot that I haven't shown, that I showed in the previous presentations on this topic, which means that nowadays we also have the quenching of the transverse strength, and I will focus on the implications of these changes in the later on, but this was clearly our miscalculation. We found that this, indeed there should be a similar reduction in both the transverse and the longitudinal parts, and this led us to the fact that there was a mistake in the calculation. Okay, but within these plots, the solid black is the final result, and one can see that still, for example, for the highest momentum transfer, so the bottom right plot, there is still some strength missing. If we go to, let me first go to this. If we look at the ratios of transverse to longitudinal, now we can see that even the black line, after adding these correlations, it does enhance our comparison to data, but doesn't fix the longitudinal to transverse ratio because correlations more or less act similarly in both cases. And how do these correlations get there? If we look at the difference between the impulse approximation and correlated calculation in the responses, we can distinguish these correlations that I was talking about. The green and the blue, so the dashed and the dotted, are different choices for central correlations, while the other two colors are tensor spin, isospin parts. I'm sorry for this calculation clearly not being finished. I made some last moment changes in the, and it's, I didn't manage to calculate it today. What one can see is that there is a slight disproportion between the longitudinal and transverse reactions. And this mostly comes from, not from the central correlation, that you can see the central correlations, so the green and the blue, they provide quenching in both longitudinal and transverse. This is an absolute number, that's why the magnitude is a bit different, but also the magnitude of the whole response are a bit different. What is interesting here is that the tensor and isospin tend to cancel each other in the transverse channel, so the transverse is really central correlations dominated because other effects counterweight each other, while for the longitudinal, we don't really have the tensor correlations effect, which are very, very tiny. This is this magenta line. And actually, spin isospin are quite low. So that's why we observe slightly higher quenching in the longitudinal channel rather than transverse channel. But all in all, the effect is quite similar. There is a reduction in both cases. Yes, and this is the ratio, but yes, this doesn't fix the whole physics of this interaction. To do that, we have to go into more other dynamic effects, such as Meson exchange currents. So we explicitly, in our framework, we calculate also the Siegel currents, pine and flight currents, and the delta degree, and the currents involving the delta degrees of freedom. And here on the right-hand side, for Q400, so this was the middle column of previous plots, one can see how they act in the transverse channel. And this is important to mention that in the first approximation for electron scattering, we only have transverse Meson exchange currents. So that's why we show only the transverse part. And you can see that including these Siegel and pine and flight currents doesn't really change that much the result. However, adding delta currents really enhances the transverse response, and this is kind of an effect we were looking for. As I mentioned before, there was some missing strength in this part. Very quickly about the description of propagators of delta in our things. This is for people that are more familiar with this subject. This is somewhat the evolution of historical evolution of these models, because they used to start as the static ones, which had no resonating behavior. Some of the older papers from like still 25 years old papers had introduced the resonating approach when some propagators were just sums of some, yeah, the resonating propagators. But nowadays, the discussion is mostly between the solid blue and the dashed blue, where one could take the full propagators both in the S and U channels, or just limit ourselves only to the real part of the, especially of the first one. I show here how dramatic the difference is, and why this difference, why do we even consider this? Because there is some sort of potential double counting and interplay with the, basically there is a battle of the strength of the delta resonance between this virtual pion production for delta currents and the real pion production in the single pion production channels that I will also mention a bit later. How do these Meson exchange currents modify the one nucleon knockout strength? Well, here on this plot, you can see that the purple is the Siegel. So in our model, which is apparently not all the models predict this kind of, let's say, signs of these effects. In our model, the Siegel provides the reduction of 1P1A strength. Pine and flight provides enhancement. So you can see the orange one is a coherent sum of these two channels. And in the end, just Siegel and pine and flight don't do much because they tend to counterweight each other. The dominant effect comes from the delta currents. So you can see this blue dashed. And finally, all together is the gray dashed. So you can see that in all of these scenarios, mesin exchange currents tend to provide extra strength in one nucleon knockout reactions. Okay, so how does it look like all together? So if we sum coherently impulse approximation, short-range correlations, and mesin exchange currents, both in 1P1H and 2P2H reaction channels, then we have this solid black line that still in the longitudinal response, we overestimate slightly the situations, which is a clear indication of the fact that we need more correlations, especially for lower energies. We need some sort of long-range correlations that are not taken into account in this model. And in the transverse part, things seem to be fine until higher momenta that nowadays we slightly underestimate the situation. However, here I have to clarify that the 2P2H calculation here is still, let's say, the old 2P2H calculation. So I'm not exactly sure what will happen to the short-range correlation part around the bit here, bit around the quasi-elastic peak. Unfortunately, these calculations really take a lot of time. So after latest changes to our model, it will take a few weeks to be able to produce plots like this. Okay, and if you think about the interplay between short-range correlations correlations and mesin exchange currents, how they affect the 1P1H strength in our model, and you can see that the short-range correlations really quench the longitudinal response, while in the transverse part, we can see this kind of interplay between the effects, where short-range correlations go down, mesin exchange currents put the response up, and in the end, we have this red curve, which kind of, there's a slight quenching in the lower energies and slight enhancement in the higher energies. And very importantly, how does it affect the ratio between the transverse and longitudinal parts? And now we can finally see that the adding mesin exchange currents is crucial if you want to reproduce these kind of plots. I think it's easiest. It's the easiest if we just look at the solid black line, which is the final result. And you can see that especially for higher omega, the shape of the response of this ratio goes correctly according to data. For lower, there is still slightly maybe some slight problem, but as I said, we also need to recalculate the two nucleon contribution to this to be able to provide the final verdict on that. All of this was electrons, but it's very nice to also that we also can provide the same, all of the same calculations for neutrino case, so for the inclusive neutrino calculation. And here there is a slight difference. So in the top row, this is this longitudinal one, which is a combination of CCCL and L responses according to how they enter the cross section. And here you can clearly see that suddenly we have mesin exchange current contribution in the longitudinal channel, which we didn't have in electrons. This is mostly because the axial currents right now, I mean, for example, the delta currents have the longitudinal, provide the longitudinal currents, which enter exactly the longitudinal response. So within our model, we start to have a very visible axial input to the longitudinal strength, while the transverse looks relatively similar to electrons. Then if we look at how the two-body currents affect one nucleon knockout, here you can see that, first of all, both mesin exchange currents and short-range correlations affect all of these channels. So there is no such a situation like for electrons that SRCs only affect the longitudinal and the transverse is affected by both. Here, all of them are affected. So yes, so we can see that there are some, say, more general differences between the electron scattering and neutrino scattering, which are even more pronounced if we go to the ratio. Because now, if we look at the ratio of transverse to longitudinal response for neutrino scattering, one thing that is quite common is that, first of all, yes, the reaction is much more transverse. And you can see the order of magnitude of these numbers. It used to be between 2 to 4 or something like this. Right now, we can see that for higher Q, we operate on the between 10 to 20 in this order of magnitude. So it's much more transverse. However, the energy dependence of this ratio actually is the opposite. It used to go up for electrons. For neutrinos, it goes down. And this is exactly because, let me go back 2 slides earlier. It's exactly because we do have this mass exchange contribution to the longitudinal channel too. So yeah, I just basically wanted to emphasize here that making strong statements on how these things work out for neutrinos based on electron scattering case has to be done very carefully, because yeah, transition from electrons to, we can clearly with the same model make a transition from electron scattering case to neutrino scattering case, but a lot of things actually change. The isospin of initial final pairs is different, so the now we have the axial part, so we have to be very careful with that.
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, Gaetan, please go ahead.
Yes, I had a technical problem. Okay, so okay, sorry, I got distracted. Okay, so now that I presented the model, let me finally go to some something that is more perhaps easier to describe in terms of like actual cross sections. So here you can see the comparison to the quite famous JLab Hall A data. So this is this measurement, the whole series of measurements and papers devoted to measuring the argon spectral function. But these are the results done for a carbon target. So here on the left, we see, like in both cases, the red color is the one nucleon knockout reaction. Blue is the two nucleon knockout, green is single pion production, and all together is the black. But what is the difference between two plots? On the left-hand side, we vary different central correlation functions. So basically, we try to put some theoretical degrees of freedom on our SRC impact on this calculation. While on the right-hand side, there is the story between what I tried to mention earlier, taking the full strength of delta or limiting ourselves only to the real part of the propagator, which is a common practice across different meson exchange current models. And here, so the single pion production is the prediction of the hybrid model of Ghent. However, this prediction has no immediate modifications of the delta. So here on the right-hand side, one can very clearly see that there is this exactly this battle of the strength of the delta, where using different parameterizations of things like delta self-energy or cutting this propagator or also including some, for example, distorted calculations for single pion production, we can really have this interplay between different effects. And I wouldn't say that this region is well understood, even on the level of electron scattering, inclusive electron scattering. We have a lot of doubts about potential double counting in this region. If we add up the two plots, we can see the results where we vary both the correlations and the delta prescriptions. And well, I have received some constructive criticism a number of times, which I'm very grateful for the fact that this calculation seemed to overestimate the quasi-elastic peak, and there seemed to be no effect which is not accounted for that would reduce this strength. We mentioned sometimes the lack of long-range correlations, but these energies are way too high for this to have any impact here. So this is one problem of this plot, and the second thing is obviously the this uncertainty and the problem describing the delta peak. So this is how the model, let's say, looked like half a year ago, or maybe more. What has changed recently is, let me go to this. Is the fact that we found indeed a problem in the short-range correlated part. So now the green one is the modern new calculation that is very, very fresh, where you can see that this uncertainty due to central correlations grew very much from the red band to the green band. And you can see that even the solid blue, which is actually our preferred choice of the central correlation, is even below the data. However, if you add two nucleon knockout to this picture, however, this is the old two nucleon knockout, which we expect that will also change, but only slightly. We have a very nice black band from the dashed black to solid black that quite nicely goes through the quasi elastic peak. So if you were worrying about the previous plot where the strength was too high, we successfully managed to battle this issue, and it seems that the model is validated right now, and we do not expect any more changes to this. So we can focus actually on let's say the parameterizations, like looking into the parameters that enter our calculation and try to understand how they reflect the reality. So let me go to this plot. So as I mentioned before, okay, there is the 2 P2H calculation. There is this question of taking the full delta propagator or only the real part. However, what we also find is that our calculation is actually very, very sensitive to the choice of the e-medium effects of the delta experiences. So the difference here between these results is that the blue one is our standard calculation, which involves Ossett-Salcedo parameterization, but only for the imaginary part of the delta width. Then this light blue is the Chen Li, so it's a bit less sophisticated, but this is both the real and imaginary part of the delta self energy. And finally, the magenta one is the parameterization taken from, I believe, is the same as done in the Valencia model. So you can see how drastically, especially with the full delta propagator, how drastically this result can change. It's still the black curve is still adding the blue one, but you can see that clearly. We can really make this cross section much higher. But also what is very interesting is that if we actually limit ourselves only to the real part, so we take the dashed line, you can see that really the peak can really shift to the left to really reside in the deep region. So this is something I, as a person responsible for development of this model, I try not to hide, to kind of give the community the understanding of how much potential model tuning can be involved in that, and how much the avoiding double counting single pion production can actually backfire if we change the single pion production model. So all of these things are not really taken into account if we think about Monte Carlo generators. There, people very, very easily shuffle between one quasi-elastic models and single pion production and different 2P2H models. Why basically, my personal opinion is that these things should go together. We can manipulate certain parameters, but we have to keep in mind that we can very easily provoke double counting between different effects and obtain way too high cross section or too low if we try to reduce everything. So we have to be extremely careful about this. And one thing here I also want to point out is that if you look at this plot, which is our latest plot, you can see that right now after fixing our problems, we do have some strength in the deep region, which clearly points out that that we have some space for moving the delta lower. So yeah, this is a very fresh plot I wanted to share with you to show you the current status of the situation, but it seems like we have everything under control and we can really move to this part of research where we try to pick the best in-medium modification of the delta for our calculation, and also trying to avoid double counting with the single pion production model, but also trying to emphasize that for whatever choice of models to describe other dynamics, basically this process should be redone every time to make sure that we really have the proper parametrization. Okay, so I also mentioned that certain things about implementation of this model in the Nouveau Monte Carlo generator. So the way it's implemented, it's so far done on the level of the inclusive implementation. So there is a tabularization of the of this two nucleon knockout model. And if we put it into Nouveau, and here I show the total cross section for different models for muon neutrinos on carbon as a function of energy. So just to like for a comparison, 1p1h using the spectral function is the red curve, and then here we have different 2p2h models, where the orange one is the Valencia model, the purple one is Sousa V2 model, and then I try to show some dependency on different parameters. So if you see if you look, the dashed blue and the solid blue are our calculations, but exactly cutting this delta propagator. So without doing it, we would have a very, very large two nucleon knockout strength that would clearly interfere with single pion production. If we cut it, okay, then we land somewhere just above the Valencia model, but we don't find actually a good solution to this problem, and to be honest, physics could lie somewhere in the blue band. Then just to also show you one more thing, if we look at the dashed yellow line, this is the dashed blue calculation but done with plane waves. So you can see on this plot the magnitude of effect, the magnitude of the reduction of the cross section, if we go from the plane wave calculation to the distorted wave calculation. Well, I guess majority of this effect could be connected to perhaps some Pauli blocking that could be done improperly. This I'm not sure, but for sure the distorted wave calculation is our number one choice for that. So this is the plot. If we try to compare to some inclusive cross sections, inclusive neutrino cross sections, I can show you some comparison to T2K data for the inclusive one. And this is a Nouveau simulation with the spectral function as a one nucleon knockout model. Then the 2p2h is done by our Ghent model, and then finally the single pion production is the standard Nouveau prescription with the delta model connected with the DIS regime and Pythia. So what we find is most likely too much strength, especially in the peak. Like we tend to be a bit quite high on these plots. And this is a clear indication of most likely double counting the effects, because if we run the one nucleon knockout model based on spectral function that already includes some correlations, that already includes some various effects, and we try to connect it to only our 2p2h, most likely there's clearly double counting between these two models. So I still think there is a long way for us to be able to actually provide consistent results for neutrinos that can be useful. Because we cannot just, if you really want to be fair, we cannot just provide a two nucleon knockout model. We need to provide a one nucleon knockout model, two nucleon knockout model, and also having it parametrized together with some preferred single pion production model. So I have a feeling that this the whole situation is a bit more difficult than one might think. Okay, but we also have means to do that. All of the calculations that I showed before I showed the inclusive ones because there we have some electron scattering data to compare to. But all of this, we can also produce the semi-inclusive two-nucleon knockout, so where we detect only one nucleon and we know the second one also left the nucleus, or we can actually provide even the exclusive two-nucleon knockout. However, yes, these calculations seem to be too numerically time-consuming to find their way into Monte Carlo generators in the current state, but we're working on it. So if I can show you some conclusions. So first of all, I wanted to maybe announce for the first time ever quite officially that our model has passed the validation stage, and we are quite confident that our model predicting one and two nucleon knockout via one and two body currents using the short range correlations and mesons change currents, which I described, is really ready to provide meaningful results. So right now we're going to approach the process of producing results and trying to perhaps find some parameterizations of our theoretical degrees of freedom that will match electron scattering best, so we can then extrapolate these things to neutrino scattering. As I wrote here in the third point, yes, we have the theoretical degrees of freedom that gives us a lot of flexibility to actually try to understand where we are compared to inclusive electron scattering. And this entry inclusive implementation in NUVRO, it definitely requires more consistency. I don't think this is the beginning of the journey to really have a consistent working model. So finally, about the future plans of our group is, first of all, finding the optimal choice of parameters. So this is something that we're trying to do right now to try to understand which parameters, for example, which parameterization of the medium delta properties fits our framework best. Then the plan is to release the entry NUVRO implementation for public use, but yes, this requires consistent parameterization. Also, it requires redoing the whole calculation according to latest changes in the model. So this will take a bit of time. In the third point, I wrote that incorporating the CRPA calculations. So we do have an idea how to consistently include long range correlations into the current framework. And this is mostly maybe for higher energies is not that important, but let me jump very quickly perhaps to this slide. You can see that if we talk about low momentum transfers, there we still have too much strength, and we expect that this is exactly the kind of quenching that is missing, and this exactly can be provided by the CRPA model also developed here in Ghent. And finally, yes, the next steps on our agenda is really to explore the exclusive and semi-inclusive 2P2H reactions, maybe also in future also the exclusive 2P2H reactions in both electron and neutrino scattering. So there is a plenty of one nucleon knockout data for electron scattering that we can really validate our model, and then it would be great to be able to have this all implemented in Monte Carlo generators, so it can be really used in neutrino experiments. Okay, thank you very much. That's all from me.
Thank you very much, Kaitan, for being perfect in time. So we have lots of time for the discussion, and I'm looking for raised hands. Okay, Luis, I see you. Yeah, Luis first and then Jeremy. Please go ahead, Luis.
Hello, Kaitan. Thanks for the presentation. Can you go back to slide 17, I think? I have a few comments.
Mm-hmm. This one?
Not really. It's the one with the diagrams, maybe the one before.
Okay.
This one. So this is a good setting for the comments I have. So first thing I want to say here is that when you have in the diagrams with the delta propagators, you consider a number of options here for this propagator. And in the I want to stress that in the case of a full delta propagator, including width, there is no double counting, contrary to what you said. So that it is not possible to put, even if you are doing a Dyson resummation of the delta propagator, including self energies that contain a pion nucleon loop, cutting rules in field theory would not allow you to put those pions on shell for these diagrams. You have well defined initial and final state. So I want to stress this because you mentioned double counting several times in the presentation, and I don't discard that there can be double counting issues elsewhere, but not here, not in this point.
Okay, let me maybe just comment. Like, okay, I agree. Okay, so I need a better I need a better word to let's say describe what's happening here in the delta region, where clearly
no doubt but the problems would be elsewhere. I think one of the possibilities is, again, I also want to stress that the moment you have two nucleon currents involved in the delta, that automatically implies that the consistency of your own model implies that you have you have broadening of the delta wave in the propagator. It might not be easy to calculate those two things consistently, but one should always keep in mind that this is there. So that is a possibility. Some broadening that would make your peak lower and broader, I think. One can argue about how to properly calculate this broadening and its value. That can be tricky, I admit. But this is a possibility.
For me, it seems like whatever choice I make, if I try to mention here, it seems like it's
fine. I mean, I don't have a solution. I wish I had, but
yeah.
I mean, first I mentioned a place where there, in my opinion, there cannot be a double counting. That's to begin with. Second, yes, you try options like keeping only the real part of the propagator. If I understand well, that has been done in the literature.
Yeah, this is like, I believe it's like idea of Arturo de Pace, and I think
I don't feel comfortable with that because that's altering the unitarity of the theory.
Yeah.
I don't like that. And my very last comment is that in the set of diagrams that you had, again, I think it was page 16. So if you have Siegel and pion in flight, this is a common set of diagrams, but if you have Siegel and pion in flight currents alone, ignoring the correlation kind of diagrams, you don't conserve the vector current, you don't recover the partial conservation, the conservation of the axial current in the chiral limit. I know it is those two diagrams are not usually included because they are treated differently. They are usually put in spectral function. I'm not saying that this is an easy problem, but I think it is important to keep in mind that the model that you have here in this slide has a problem with the current conservation, which probably it's not a big deal, but maybe not in all kinematics. I don't know. When you have a bivalent in a symmetry, it is when it might show up in places one don't expect. That's just a warning.
Yeah, yeah. So let's say, yeah. So for the delta currents, we have no problems. For
yeah, sure, sure.
In flight, there is a common, I think it's a prescription by Towner to introduce additional form factors that would get rid of it. However, if I try to properly calculate this, the inclusion of these form factors, my calculation tends to diverge completely. So
that sounds like an ad hoc.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there is some integral that so basically because I introduce form factors to hadronic form factors.
Yeah.
And if I try to recover CVC, I basically need to calculate something which brings like removes the hadronic factors again, and then it's it's a total mess to actually do it.
I know the feeling, but well, Even all I'm saying is that if you remove form factors from this set of diagrams, this set alone doesn't violate current conservation. The current conservation. That's my.
Are you sure? Just the
Yeah,
signal and pipe
yeah,
split?
yeah. You need the correlation diagrams where you couple the external current to the nucleus of the coil.
Okay. I'm surprised. I'm pretty sure it was okay, but okay. I
Well,
can.
you double check and let me know if.
Okay, no, I was always I have a feeling that it was fine.
Yeah, but
But
the
yeah,
correlation should be in the mean field, I think.
Right, but
yeah, but
I understand the reason why they are not included, Natalie. I'm not. I know, but since when you do different things in two different parts of the current, you violate the current conservation. It again. I'm not sure this is a big deal. I cannot claim this is a big deal.
No.
But again, one should be careful
Yeah, but
numerically. I mean.
We checked current conservation, and even if it's not perfect.
So okay,
yeah,
you
yeah.
have, but
For one
that's
nuclear knockout,
a
there is no
point.
problems. So for one nuclear knockout, for sure, there is no problems with current conservation in our model. For two nuclear knockouts, well, I start to have problems with like physical interpretation of this because, you know, we don't really include some absorption or other FSI things, and well, I guess CVC should be, I mean, you should have conservation of the on the whole final state, right? A particular final state, to my understanding. So there are like some unquantifiable effects. So I agree that yes, it's great if the currents conserve, the vector current is conserved on the level of currents. I think it helps a lot. But to my understanding, it should be also conserved, actually conserved on the whole process.
Okay.
That's my understanding. But
okay, let me interrupt this because I see more hands. So Jeremy and then Ulrich, please. Jeremy, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. And Katan, this is quite a nice bit of work here. I have a much simpler question, which is, so you mentioned at the beginning, this is a non-relativistic model. And I'm wondering where the, like, so I saw your cross-section for neutrinos, for example, goes out to about 2 GeV. And I was wondering if, where we would see the impact of the sort of relativistic degrees of freedom that are missing, if, you know, you were to try to extend it higher. Do we start to see that in missing strength in the cross section somehow, or is it a distortion in the kinematics, or what would that look like?
Well, first of all, we do correct our kinematics for, let's say, for the relativistic effects, because so without corrections, we would never be able to match quasi-elastic peak, for example, right? We really need to do these things. So this model is already at certain, at a few points, relativistically corrected. Still, I think it's, we don't see any problems with our relativistic corrections within electron scattering kinematics that we can test. So even to, I would say, 2-3 GeV in electron scattering, like in incoming energy, I wouldn't say we have problems with in one nuclear knockout. What is nice about all of this is that the two nuclear knockout, which dominates the higher energies later, well, in two nuclear knockouts, you distribute the energy between two nucleons. So there is this funny thing, and even if you think in future of some like three nuclear knockouts or something like this that should lie in higher in energies, always the energy then get dispersed between more and more nucleons. So they individually, they don't have to be that much relativistic. So there is this nice feature that actually for us, the relativistic corrections are more important for 1p1h rather than for 2p2h. And 1p1h resides at slightly lower energies. But trying to answer your question as directly as possible, I don't think we managed to stretch the model so far to really have relativistic problems. treating our model with these relativistic corrections. I would say that we experience other types of problems, numerical problems, but they appear earlier than that, I would say. So it's difficult for me to respond to this question. I wouldn't say relativity is our biggest problem.
Let me ask a more specific version of it then. I mean, would it be reasonable to extend the model, for example, to 4 or 5 GeV, or is that too far?
In what?
Neutron energy, sorry.
No, so, for example, the one nucleon knockout, yeah, maybe it will survive. I haven't tried that far.
It depends on the energy transfer and energy
exactly, and
momentum. That's the relevant part to judge whether you really need neutron to T or not. And this is quasi-elastic and 2P2H. So you won't go to DIS with it's just not in this model. If that's what you use the 5 GeV for.
The strength of this model really lies in slightly lower energies. And
The reason I was asking is because when you compare MEC-based models in particular for 2P2H in the soups that we always use, the concoctions and generators to high energy data than C2K or microboon, you start to see bigger discrepancies. And, it's hard for experimentalists like me to judge what the missing degrees of freedom might be as you go to higher energy. So that's sort of why I'm probing.
These models have like 2P2H models, all of them have cutoffs, right?
Yeah. The
SUSE V2, I think the way it's implemented is 2 GeV in Q and Omega. The Valencia model, I think it's 1.2 GeV. So I think our model can be safely run to 1.3 GeV in energy transfer. This is what I tested to be safely done. The problem later is most likely the relativity will not be that big of a problem, but for us, it's just that the certain integrals, like we would most likely need to increase precision of integrals because, I mean, if you think of how does the wave function of the continuum states, you know, how they look like for these very highly energetic nucleons, they would be like very highly oscillating functions that we already struggle to integrate over. These are our biggest concerns. I think if you look at, let's say, cross sections predicted in Monte Carlos by the SUSE V2 model or the Valencia model, I would expect the highest difference is actually from the fact that there is a cutoff and you just increase the phase space with higher and higher energies of your neutrinos, but then the Valencia has a limit and it cannot grow, while the SUSE really uses the phase space to provide more and more cross section. So I would expect that maybe these kind of effects happen around there.
Okay. Thanks.
The next question is by Ulrich. Please go ahead. Ulrich, are you there? Maybe you are muted, Ulrich. Okay, maybe he will join us later. So, Steve. Steve, are you there? Okay.
Yes, I am.
If not, Steve Noemi.
I'm surprised Ulrich is unmuted. He should be there. I'll give Ulrich a chance for another few seconds.
But go ahead. I will remember.
Two comments. First of all, you mentioned, I'm really happy that you mentioned E prime P, and I would push that really hard because you will have a whole new spectrum of new possibilities open to you. The effects of correlations are much, much more obvious in EE prime P. So I think you'll find that extremely exciting.
I agree. I think we're getting there.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes. Okay,
I'm already here. Okay, so sorry, my microphone wasn't quite on. First of all, I really loved that talk. This was a very nice, very complete story about the 2P2H problem, and I love that. So I had two comments. One is directly related to what Luis already had mentioned before. I was wondering, what do you do about the background amplitudes? I mean, the delta excitation is always the resonance part. That's the amplitude in the lower lines. And then there's background. And then there is an additional background, which Luis mentioned, which is missing. And all of these things have to be added coherently. And I was wondering, how do you do that in particular if you want to implement that into the Monte Carlo code? How does one handle that? That's not so trivial. And I was just interested in your plans. And then I had another question afterwards.
Okay, so, I mean, well, to my understanding, if we talk about Seagull and Pine in Flight, I mean, these things are actually equivalents of backgrounds in the non-resonant background in single pine production, for example, right? You have some conductor.
Yeah, that's right. So
pine
yeah.
Pole stuff. The correlation functions, they're like nucleon pole things, but yeah, we don't include the correlation, the correlation diagrams.
But as soon as you plug it into a Monte Carlo, then you have a problem because Monte Carlo cannot really handle coherent summations and you have to make some sort of recipe or so. And
So far we only put the coherent sum together. So let's say if I talk about this entry implementation in Nouvreau, this is already a whole complete 2P2H thing. It includes all the correlation effects or the meson exchange currents. Everything is added coherently inside. Mm-hmm. And the Nouvreau receives basically only the cross-section already, right? Almost. Okay. Well, in terms of responses, but still.
Okay, fine.
Yeah,
So
maybe, actually, it's nice that you invoked this because, I somehow skipped it in the presentation. Within my model, this is the same. This is only the 2P2H part of this JLab data comparison I was showing.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the blue is meson exchange current, the green is short range correlations, and you see that there's actually a negative interference between current.
Okay, so fine. And that negative part is of course tricky if one wants to treat that in some sort of Monte Carlo code.
If on the Monte Carlo level, somebody wants to say, tell me, was it a meson exchange current event or short range correlated event?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to put the negative weights for events with interference, negative events, mm-hmm. anti-events. Statistically speaking, if you introduce anti-events that would mimic interference, then if you later do cross sections and things like this, things would add up. That's not a problem. But then, how do you interpret? How would people experimentally interpret negative events?
Okay, fine. Thank you. And then I was interested in your quite detailed discussion of transverse versus longitudinal. Could you go to slide 23? I didn't have really enough time to look at that. Yeah, what I was sort of amazed about was the very right hand of these plots, you know, at the very end. Let's say we take the right figure, which is Q550, and the omega goes to 550, and therefore the Q squared is really zero at the right part. Q squared zero means real photon, and real photons are all transverse. But on the other hand, this ratio goes down to the right, and that I don't quite understand.
Well, I cannot say I fully understand these plots myself. This is like actually a very recent plot. We haven't thought about actually plotting the ratio for neutrinos before. So I wouldn't say I had enough time to properly interpret that.
How does this look for photons? You know, I mean, my argument, of course, is true only for photons, really. But photons should really go up at the right hand side and not go down.
But it's also, I don't know, maybe because it's for neutrinos, right? So there is both the vector and axial part, and
So would be good to produce pictures like that within your model for the photons as well, or for electrons, and see how that goes.
Yeah, but so I have for electrons.
Okay. Right?
And it's for electrons, you can see that it really goes up, but then you see that the I don't know, the 1p1h strength, the red one really goes very high, so maybe it really becomes
yeah. But what is the total there? And the total is the black curve.
Yes, that's the total. But
both
1p1h, but
okay, which again goes down. So that means at q squared equal to zero, you would have zero cross section there, and it sounds strange. But anyway, this would be something to check, I think.
Yeah, but you know, it's a direct consequence of, is it the proper one? Yeah, plots like this,
mm-hmm.
where in the longitudinal, okay, there is a slowly growing 2p2h contribution coming from short-range correlations, while in the transverse part, you have the resonating...
But the longitudinal should really not be growing to the right side. It should go to zero. I mean, okay. at the end, you have a Q 550 and you have an omega 550, and therefore Q squared is zero. And therefore you have a real photon point there. And at the real photon point, everything is transverse.
Yeah.
So okay, something goes wrong with this red curve. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. No, that's very interesting. I did not think of it in that
terms. Okay, fine.
Also, like, I don't care that much about this place, because in reality, for cross sections, I mean, the leptonic factors for us will like kill this tail anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really the in the cross sections, it's not that actually visible, but so maybe this could be the reasoning. I don't know exactly, because this is really the hadronic response, right? There is no it's not a cross section, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me interrupt. We have still three questions. So Steve Dyckman, Steve, you started your question, and then
yes, thank you. Yeah, it was a very abrupt change there. Well, I want to reaffirm that E prime P is just a whole new section of stuff. Very interesting phenomena. And correlations show up in very different ways. You only see correlations fairly suppressed here. There's little slight gradations, whereas in E prime P, it'll be almost everything in some kinematics.
Yeah.
There is a lot of data on higher mass nuclei, argon, and particularly iron. Is there some reason you've avoided the higher mass nuclei?
I would say currently it's just a technical problem. It's the numerical complexity is higher, right? There's more nucleons, so really the time of these calculations really grows.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the current status is I only show results for carbon and oxygen, and this I would say at a certain moment this project really had to be cut, because I really needed to finish my PhD finally. Because otherwise I could go forever with adding new things.
Sure.
I tried to make calcium results. Like, I tried to compare to calcium cross sections, but yeah, the problem really was that in order for these calculations to converge, the minimal quanta of my calculations was higher than the time limit for a process on a supercomputer, so I would say that it's a really technical thing, and the plan is that after we resolve all the problems with carbon and oxygen, we will really try to go to calcium and then to argon. Obviously, that it will be it is on our to-do list to go that way.
That's good. I'll cut off there, but I'll say that obviously, applications to argon are pretty important in the future. And if you have technical difficulties, that's really interesting. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we have still Noemi and Steve Gardiner. So Noemi, please go ahead.
Yeah, I had a further comment on the relativistic effects, because you said that you are not worried about it. However, the kinematics that you show for the JLab measurements, so I think in order to reproduce the position of the peak and the strength, there you include some relativistic effects in the Bose-elastic, yes. Right?
Yes.
But since, you know, like, in the end, it's an approximate way to do it, I think it will be interesting also to have a band that accounts for that and shows how much is this effect. And it's also keep in mind that it's, sorry?
Like without the standard relativistic corrections, our results would be nonsense here.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, but however, it's not an exact treatment. So I think it will be important to account for this in a way, you know, like at least mentioning it and showing how much it changes, because it's not completely exact. And this also gives you a band. In a way.
Yeah, so let me...
Because you're correcting the kinematics, but not much the currents, I guess.
Yeah, so we tried different things. So fixing the kinematics, let's say, using the relativistic kinematics, it's absolute necessity. Without this, our results would be nonsense. So this is like an absolute necessity. But then we did try different prescriptions for... to introduce some sort of effective momentum transfer, these kind of things further on, but these the uncertainty on this procedure is very, very small, so the our results don't really change that much no matter what we try. The relativistic kinematics is absolutely necessary. Without this, it makes no sense. But later on, we didn't find that much difference between these.
Different. No, that is fair. But you know, like then when you follow up with the discussion, that you see a small discrepancy and necessarily needs to be, you know, I think, yeah. Yes, this so part here. What I'm claiming is, you know, if you see such an effect in the kinematics, it's because Q is relatively large here. So I think it's also interesting to understand what's the role of relativistic correction in the current, so higher order, higher than Q square over mass squared, which are not included. Just saying, you know, like it might, I think it's fair to mention it, you know, that kinematics here, that relativity here, it's relevant. And the other question that I had is, you mentioned that you are not worried about relativistic effects for the 2P2H. And I was wondering why, you know, like it, how can you claim that they are small if you had any way to check? And again, I'm not just talking about the kinematics, but also like in the current.
So I'm talking only about the kinematics. So the I am not worried because the while the different using the relativistic kinematics in one nuclear knockout, the distance is the difference is drastic. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But for two nuclear knockout, the difference is not that large. So for us, just applying the standard correction for the kinematics makes some difference on two nuclear knockout, but it's relatively small. So this is why I say that it seems to me that, let's say, delta properties are much more uncertain rather than the relativistic effects. It seems like this from...
Got it. I mean, it's good that you use like the propagator. I think that one, the full propagator of the delta, I think that one helps already a lot in grasping the correct relativistic behavior. But I think it will still be interesting in checking what's the difference for the current, you know, like for the fully relativistic current operator versus the one that you're using. But thanks a lot. That was a very interesting talk and very nice results.
Thank you. I also agree with you that... this is a kind of a study that we will have to eventually do. Just, I wouldn't say it's our priority right now, but it is top 10 for sure.
Okay, so we still have Stephen Gardiner question. Steve, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much. Very interesting talk, Gaetan. Lots of interesting stuff to ask here. I'll restrict myself to one question. And I think you may have hinted at this a little bit, but I was wondering if you could expand on it. I'm basically going to ask the inverse of, I think Jeremy was the one who originally asked about extensions to higher energies. That's one of the strengths of the Ghent group's treatment for 1P1H is that you can go to quite low energies near the nucleon knockout threshold. We expect it to do a good job in treating some of the relevant nuclear effects down there. I was curious if you can comment on the level of quality you expect the two-body treatment to achieve in that similar energy range, the low tens of MeV. Just to comment on, you know, whether it's comparably strong, do you think, or has some limitations?
Yeah, so I think the top left plot here should like kind of respond to your question. That's basically the difference between the dashed black and the dashed red is how much of a two-body the how inclusion of our this current two-body short-range correlations, how it affects the response for lower for lower energies for lower momentum transfer, energy transfer. So you can see that clearly this is not enough. I would say that the strength of our treatment of short-range correlations is slightly higher, where we can really say, okay, this and this much and this and this much strength went from one nucleon knockout channel to the two nucleon knockout channel, where obviously it's higher in energies that I think you you work with normally. And here, as I kind of hinted this in my presentation, we really need longer long range correlations to properly describe these lower energetic kinematics with lower energies in general. And we have a plan how to do it. There seem to be no problems in basically substituting our standard one-body currents with CRPA. We can do it. The problem is potential double counting. This is a problem because I already hint that, yes, short-range correlations also have an effect in lower energies, while CRPA was, let's say, designed to cover all of it for lower energies. So there is clearly some sort of double counting between this. And it will, yeah, for us, it's, let's say, one most likely one more parameter to fit in order to avoid this double counting. However, this one is relatively nice because we can really only focus only on like lower energies. So we don't have to go into delta currents, description of delta resonance and things like this, but we could really focus on like low energy quasi-lattice scattering and then to really quantify it, the double counting between CRPA and the SRC treatment. And then we hope that this model would like, yes, solve all the issues in lower energies.
Okay.
All right, yeah, thanks very much. Sounds like a very interesting frontier to explore.
Yeah, it is. It has become quite late, but okay. To Kaitan, please don't remember to send us your slides. We will make them public. And the last question,
delivered by
Marco Martini. Yes. Please, Marco, go ahead.
Yeah. So hi, Kaitan. So in your answer to Ulrich, you show one backup slide in which there is the interference between the short-range correlation and mesoid change current.
Yes.
Yeah. And you obtain a negative result. I would like just to mention that in the calculation of Alberico, Erickson, and Molinari for electron scattering, that then we generalize to neutron scattering, this interference contribution is positive.
Mm-hmm. But is it for, yeah, but you say for neutrinos, but also in electron scattering? I remember we discussed it.
Oh, so yeah. Yes. It's a, yeah, analog well, of field of 84. Yeah.
Yeah. So my argument about this is, let's say, the relative signs of these things for me are consistent with the effect on electron scattering, like that there is this interplay of correlations going down and the Meissner change currents going up. So this is why for me this interference seems reasonable. That my intuition is that these are competing effects. But of course, this is 1p1h and this interference that we discussed was 2p2h. So,
yeah,
so
exactly.
It can be different, sure. But I justify it like this. But so far I didn't manage to find any mistake in that sense, but
no,
I made some changes to the model recently. So yes, as I tried to say that I finally finished the validation stage of the whole model, and I'm fairly convinced that it's finally working the way as I want to. So the most likely at this maybe this will change. I don't know. I hope that basically my plan is to show a similar presentation at NewFACT, NewIND in Brazil, where I hope that I will show similar results, but with the final version of the model, so we can see at the time. I will keep you updated on this issue.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, Kaitan, thank you very much for a great talk, and which triggered so much of discussion. I see there are still 24 people actively following it, so it is really amazing. Okay, so thank you very much, Kaitan, and also to all of you who participated in the discussion. And okay, there will be more seminars in this series. So thank you very much. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Yes, thank you, Kaitan. That was marvelous. I forgot to say that.
Thank you very much for your kind words.